When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
We're never teasing and always pleasing. We are the Decibel Geek Podcast. My name is Aaron Camaro. I have a Woody you could play sports with. My co-host is the man in the white vest that's making you scared, but you know you like it. It's Chris Sinzak. What do you say, brother?
I was going to do the Sport No Woody reference. You stole it from me.
How's it going, man?
Good. So it's been a while since we've done one of these, and I think everybody's going to really enjoy this one.
Yeah, man. It's been a minute since we've done Albums Unleashed. Everybody wants it. They always say when they're listening to their favorite episodes, it seems like Albums Unleashed is usually number one. And, you know, we haven't done one in a minute. So we thought the time is perfect to bring it back right here for you today. We've got a very special guest, and we're going to talk about a very awesome album. Stick around for that, because we got a little business to handle before we get to it. And I'm talking about reviews and recommendations. You know what's on the line. It's Kissmas in July. We've got to get to 20 before then. I know, we're holding it hostage. But I believe we can do it, especially when I see what I see in front of me right now, and that is some sweet reviews and recommendations. We're knocking them out. We're going to get there. I got a feeling we're going to get us some Kissmas in July. So let's kick it off like this. It is a Facebook recommendation. It comes to us from A to Z Radio. I think everybody that listens to Decibel Geek probably definitely knows all about A to Z Radio. The recommendation, it goes a little something like this. Decibel Geek is a unique podcast, as they are proud of the music that they grew up listening to, as well as looking forward to the future of hard rock and metal music. Chris and Aaron are a great team that have encouraged numerous podcasters as to what makes a great show. That's awesome.
Very nice. I'm wondering if that's probably Bill Elam that posted that.
I think we're going to be seeing Bill here shortly in Indianapolis, right?
Oh, is he going to be there too?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else.
I know that's up in his area, though.
Yeah, maybe. I'll have to reach out to him. I know a bunch of people that are going.
I'd love to hang out with him.
The more, the merrier. If you guys want to meet us in Indianapolis for Ugly Kid Joe, we're going to be there. That one takes us down to 10. Let's keep going. We're doing good. This one is another Facebook recommendation. It goes, great podcast. Loving Radio Sucks at Work. Keep it up, guys, and keep rocking. That one comes to us from Chris Levette, and it is a Facebook recommendation. We're down 9. Let's see. Can we keep going? Can we? We can. We've got a Podchaser review. I know it's Podchaser because it's got all 5 pink stars. Just the way we love it. And here it is. Oh, nice. I know who this is from. It comes to us from the Rated X rock star. We know him better as our friend Aaron Baker. He says this. Not much can be said that hasn't already been said about Chris and Aaron as hosts, except this. I consider these guys like family, except Chris has a Juice Newton collection, still questions me to this day. You Aaron Camaro laugh here. Right on time. Oh, man. I have been a loyal listener for just about the same length as this podcast has been around, and have even been a guest host, as well as I always find myself dying of laughter at Chris's quick wit and wait with much anticipation as a new Guns N' Roses album for Aaron's laugh as a response. Lastly, Decibel Geek is like a fine wine. It gets better with age, unlike some of the bands that we know and love from back in the day. Keep up the great work, and I'll see you guys at the next Rockin' Pod. Fan-freaking-tastic.
Great review.
Awesome review. Can't ask for much better than that. Thank you, Mr. Baker. You're awesome. There you have it. That brings us down to 10, 9, 8 left to go. I got a feeling we can probably easily get 8 reviews between now and July, but the year's gone by pretty quick already. Don't let it sneak up on us. If July 1st hits and we've got 19, it's over. So don't hesitate any longer. Get out there on Podchaser like Aaron Baker did, or hit us up on the Facebook, like the page, give us a follow, join the Decibel Geek community, all that good stuff, and give us a recommendation on there. And we especially love the Apple Podcast reviews. 5 stars will make it count. We're going to get there. July is right around the corner. We're going to have some fun with it this year, if you let us do it. It's up to you. So we love everybody that listens to this show, all the people that have said, bring back Albums Unleashed for crying out loud. And we're going to do it. We love the people that support Decibel Geek. And few people support Decibel Geek better than the people that every single week are taking the time to share and retweet when we come out with a new episode. Last time, we brought back the Radio Sucks radio show. And man, people loved it. We played some kick-ass rock and roll that you might not have heard of before. Somebody's got to play it. Might as well be us. And we love it that you love when we do it. And we know you love it because you share it, you retweet it, and that's what makes you a Geek of the Week.
Geeks of the Week this week are Adam Cox, Rockin' Ron Runyon, Kristen Schimbeck, Mark Starsky, John Phillips, Mike Stewart, Shane Hebert, Darren Lanoux, Ralph Vieira, Samuel Wetz, Eric Luzier, Nate Atchison, David Glenn, Shay Hargett, Aaron Baker, Steve Selepsky, Craig Turdick, Simon Catt, Mike Parnell, Keith Rockford, Brian Knapp, Sean Geek Podcast, and Obscuria Podcast, Jeffrey Mendenhall, Mark Alden Taylor, Freeform Rock Podcast, Mark and Jerry BS Sessions, David Cathy, Will Honeycutt, Joseph Capone, Victor Ruiz, Ernesto Aguiar, Pantheon Podcast, Kevin's on Fire, Jeff Mendenhall, Whiting Guitar Works, Vet Halen, Scott Crouch, and as always,
the Mooger Fooger. That's right, those are our people, the best in the world. You want to be a member? It's very easy. It's an elite group you can be a part of. All you got to do is find on Facebook when we share this episode, Albums Unleashed, Dangerous Toys. You take that, you share it, you retweet it, you get added to the list, you become a Geek of the Week. You'll hear your name next week right here on the Decibel Geek Podcast. You got to love that. Thank you, everybody. That gives us the love. So, any final words before we get to this awesome thing?
Nah, I know everybody's going to have fun with this. It's a supersized episode. We talked for a long time, and Jason had tons of great stories.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. I can't wait for you guys to enjoy it. So here it is. Decibel Geek is back with an all-time favorite. Albums Unleashed, the debut album from Dangerous Toys with the one and only Jason McMaster. Well, I don't know where you guys were in 1989. I guess I kind of do, but I know where I was. I was listening to hard rock and metal music. It was such a huge part of my life, and finding out about new bands all the time and watching Headbangers Ball and getting turned on to stuff. And it was what I lived for. And I'll never forget the first time that I saw Dangerous Toys on the Headbangers Ball. And I was like, oh, yeah. That's right up my alley. And I couldn't wait for the debut. So I'm excited today because it's the return of Albums Unleashed on the Decibel Geek Podcast. And today we're talking about that debut album from the Dangerous Toys. And I can't think of anybody better to tell us the story about it than Jason McMaster himself. Jason, thanks for coming on with us, brother. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. On your show to talk about myself.
Yeah, it was for me. I didn't see it on. I didn't see the first time on them. The first time on Headbangers Ball for me, it was a show called Hard 60 that MTV would do during the middle of the day, and that's also where I discovered Tora Tora and Roxy Blue and several other bands. And it was the Tease and Pleasin' video, and I remember that. And then Scared came out, and they got bigger. But I also remembered, and it was funny. I thought I couldn't remember if I was misremembering this. I remember you and another member of the band hosting Hard 60, and then I was doing my YouTube research yesterday, and sure enough, I found the clip, and I remember watching that when it happened live.
Yeah, it was me and Mark, the drummer.
Jason McMaster, we're from Dangerous Toys.
We're your guest host for today's Hard 60.
We got videos on the way from, hey Joe, how's it going, eh? Bang Tango, Guns N' Roses,
Skid Row, Aerosmith, and
Extreme.
Yeah!
It was kind of a quick day. They had us in there just do some like promos. That's what it felt like some drops, you know, and then they just edited into the show. I guess we announced a couple of videos and that was that. There was a shout out. I think I remember we played Someone Like You, Bang Tango, and I threw a shout out to Joe because we're chummy. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I would get home from school, and it would come on like 30 minutes after I got home from school, and I would get turned on to bands all that. They would play a lot of newer bands on that show. And it was not so much the established ones. It was, like I said, Tora Tora, you guys, Roxy Blue, several other bands. And then, but I mean, before we get into the album, why didn't you tell me it was your birthday on the day that we did the Rockin' Pod Expo? Oh, wow. I would have done something for you.
That's why I didn't tell you. You just answered your own question. I mean, okay, let's play along. Let's go back to that day. Hey, and by the way, it's my wedding anniversary and it's my birthday.
Oh, wow, nice.
Oh, wow.
Is that how you would have reacted? Oh, wow. So we're that day, we're in Nashville, we're doing, I'm telling you, I just told you, and then what were you going to do? So it's just, I know next time.
Yeah, balloons, confetti, no pyro, but, you know, lots of confetti.
More mess to clean up?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was already enough of one. No problem adding some more to it.
I see your point. So it wouldn't have mattered anyway.
Yeah. Wedding day and birthday, or wedding anniversary and birthday, it's a good way to remember
both.
Yeah,
so that's how awesome my wife is.
Yeah.
To let me go work on my birthday and my wedding anniversary.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, by the way, speaking of Rockin' Pod, I know I've thanked you already, but thank you. Thanks to Tyson for suggesting it to you. Me and Dave had such a blast and met a lot of folks face-to-face and learned a lot. So we just are very appreciative of that. Even first, something like that exists. Two, that we have enough episodes under our belt to actually matter enough for someone to go, hey, you should get these clowns, you know? So, really worked out. What a happy time.
Thanks, man. It was great having you. And you got a lot of great feedback on how cool you were to everybody. All the podcasters love getting to meet you and stuff. So it was fun.
It's pretty easy to be nice to people that you respect.
And appreciate and respect you back.
Ditto.
All right. Well, Aaron, how do we want to get into this? We've got a lot to cover with this album.
Before there even is such a thing as Dangerous Toys, you're in another band called Watchtower. And then, I mean, you have to transition from that band into what will later on become Dangerous Toys. But you were in that band Watchtower for a minute. Was that a tough decision to leave one band to jump to another? And what's the process on all that?
Well, I was in Watchtower when we were, me and the Watchtower guys, which has absolutely zero affiliation with Dangerous Toys camp or people or anything. It's like from another part of town, yeah, kind of thing. Literally, the musically headspace, everything. Totally another planet. How about that? Yeah. But a couple of where do I start? High school. We were in high school, me and the Watchtower guys. I was probably 17 or 18, in Watchtower. I joined in May of 1982. Wow. And then, so there, you know, it's basically a the decade prior to the time in Dangerous Toys. I started moonlighting as the singer for a number of other bands around town that just started doing covers and such. And that kind of made me approachable by other bands in town who might, you know, be doing like a club circuit, like cover band club circuit thing, which is what this band called Onyx was doing. And Onyx is a female singer from Louisiana who's a pretty good singer. She was the singer for what turned into Dangerous Toys. And I'd seen Onyx play a couple times. And so, you know, Onyx, because she had black hair and wore all black, and then the guys behind her, which ended up being Dangerous Toys, were all blonde like Poison and wore like brightly colored rodeo clown outfits. Wait, that's not right. Not really. Might as well have been rodeo clown outfits. You know, those cowboys wear those button up shirts that looks like Christmas wrapping paper. Mm. That's where I was going with that. It's like a clown vomited on it. Anyway.
So the clown thing goes back a long time.
Well, I'm just, I see what you did there, but I'm not really relating. The guys in Onyx, they look like Poison a little bit, brightly colored dress. There you go. So when they had a falling out with Onyx, a couple of the guys in Onyx had come to see Watchtower play, and Watchtower, I already alluded that it was quite different. Was this like all of the instruments falling down the stairs at the same time at the speed of light, in time?
Wow.
With me singing over it.
They were like a thrash metal band?
Correct. Pioneers of progressive thrash metal, arguably, for anyone who wants to flex and start a fight with those words. But you can ask Mike Portnoy. You could ask Chuck Schuldiner of Death, but he has sadly passed away. But those were our championing fans, the guys in Atheist, the guys in Cynic, any progressive band that sort of was happening in other scenes at the same time. They will tell you. I don't need to tell you. But somewhat of a pioneer. There's a book called Mean Deviation that you guys, I think it might be out of print. But if you can find a copy of that, you'll learn a lot. Mean Deviation, four decades of progressive metal. And, of course, Voivod and bands like that are in there. You know, Metallica, Queensryche, and Merciful Fate and Megadeth are all mentioned in there. Pretty much anybody who had, like, nine-minute songs with 10 different riffs in one song are in that book. So I come from that. And I made a record with them in 85, worldly underground critical acclaim, a lot of rock fanzines, magazines. This is before we were in glossy magazines. It was fanzines. It was tape trading and underground stuff. Some of them didn't, even if it was a thrash magazine, they didn't know how to review our record because it was quite different. They didn't know where to put us, right? What section does this go in? What kind of metal is this? Kind of a thing. So fast forward back to where I was. A couple guys in Onyx had come to visit me at my job, which was I worked at a place called Pantera's Pizza.
Wow.
Foreshadowing.
And they were a local chain. There was a south and a north location. Here in Austin, Texas, and they show up, and I thought I recognized them, and I was like, hey, can I help you guys? And they were like, oh, we're here to talk to you about you know, singing for our band, and here, da, 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 here's our number, and da, 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 da. I'd go, oh, yeah, I've seen you guys. You guys are fun, blah, blah, blah. So I ended up, you know, working with them because what they rolled out was we lost our singer. We have shows that we need that are booked that we want to do that we can still do. Of course, we'll have to change the name because, you know, the singer, that's what she went by, was Onyx. And I said, I get it. I get it. And, but this is how we fucking eat, you know, this is how we pay bills, is do a club circuit thing. And I was like, oh shit. And I was like, okay, well, let me call you guys and we'll just get together and jam and play some songs and whatever. So that happened. And then I got comfortable and they played me some songs that she had written the lyrics for without her singing on them. And I was like, oh, let me take those home. And I think Here Comes Trouble is the first lyric I wrote over one of their songs. And I think that song originally was called No More, or No More, No More, or something like that. Did you guys thank Aerosmith? Because they have a song called No More. You know, anyway.
It's a great song.
I love that old Aerosmith. First four albums of shit. Anyway, so stuff like that started to happen. Then we got a call to do a gig, and the guy was like, well, what are you going to call yourselves? And we're at the Mark, the drummer's house, and it's like they're on, you know, he's on the phone. What are we going to call this shit? Me and Scott are over there going, I don't know. Saw this bumper sticker today, Bad Boys Play with Dangerous Toys, or The One with the Most Toys Wins, or, and I was like, I think you might be onto something that's good enough. And we agreed, just Dangerous Toys, just do that. We can change it later if we hate it. Well,
wow.
It was a filler name.
Never got around to changing it. And we kind of didn't. Some of us were like, man, it's kind of terrible. So it just stuck. So we played our first show at the Back Room here in Austin, which has been gone for a while now. It was like the Watering Hole, you know. Onyx had been like the house band there, you know, like packed it out all the time, big party in there all the time. Every scene has that band, you know, your favorite cover band that's all your friends play in and everyone goes to see on Friday night because, you know, they play there every other weekend, whatever, right? So, but it was Dangerous Toys, and we started, you know, and it was the kind of thing where Onyx had all her fans standing in the back, you know, cross-armed.
Yeah.
Who's this fucking guy, you know? And then people, it was on everyone's lips, oh, shit, that's Jason from Watchtower. And people knew Watchtower already. They were like, this is going to be really good or really terrible. So I guess it stuck. For the most part, the Watchtower fans were, I was on their shit list. Because Watchtower was a big deal to them, and it was, you know, they liked the heavier ilk. They didn't really like seeing their Jason McMaster sing Faster Pussycat and Poison or whatever, right? But I mean, it was, you know, it was that version of the band was, well, here you go. I can just speak this. I can put this all on top. We weren't looking to get a record deal. We weren't trying to be anything other than a bunch of bozos playing cover songs, having a beer, and making everyone smile after they got off of work that week. That's it. That's totally it. Started writing tunes with those guys. By the way, I'm still in Watchtower.
Right.
But we only played like once a month or every couple of months or whatever because of... We used to put on our own shows. We never really found a bar, right? We would rent out a venue and charge tickets and keep the money. See what I'm saying? We had our own scene happening.
Were those guys like, what are you doing with this other band, or were they cool with it?
Well, I mean, they were welcome to be in as many fucking bands as they wanted. It wasn't a contest. You know, right. I didn't feel threatened by it. Maybe the guitar player, Ron, you know, may have said something to me like, well, just, you know, don't get too busy with that. Sorry, Ron. because, you know, Lemmy once said, and this may be, he may have stolen it from Nietzsche or something, but Lemmy said, be careful, your biggest mistake will be what you're known for.
That's wise. There's some wisdom in that.
Well, if Dangerous Toys was a mistake, it was pretty fun mistake. I did feel a lot of guilt for upsetting, being a disruptor to the Watchtower camp, but I did my damnedest to help them find replacement singers. And I did, and the guy that they ended up with, I'm the one that reached out to him. It's like, hey man, I got this thing and I got a split, you know, can you, you know, you should look into this, or what, are you busy, you know, and kind of a thing. And that's Alan Tecchio, who was in the band, a Jersey metal band called Hades.
Yep.
And they had a few couple records out, and they had just toured Europe, and he had just gotten, he declined the first time. And then he called me later and was like, you got Doug's number, you know? I was like, wow, that was a quick turn. He's like, yeah, some things went south. And I was like, well, good for Watchtower. And so he ended up rehearsing with them like one time maybe, and then they all got on a plane and went to Germany to record the first, you know, the second, it would have been Watchtower record. So I was continuing to help them and championing them the entire time. Dangerous Toys photo shoots, wearing Watchtower shirts and interviews and shit, talking about Watchtower and always bringing them up at the top of, you know, the game. And obviously I still am. Ironically, I rehearsed with Watchtower recently, and we're doing some festivals next year.
Oh, cool.
Holy shit.
Nice. Yeah.
This just in, that's crazy news. So, you know, maybe I let the cat out of the bag, but those are not confirmed, but we have been asked to play some festivals.
Cool. Well, here, you just gave us our blabbermouth headline.
That's pretty
thanks.
Damn cool.
Well, yeah, it's possible that we are to do some shows soon, but we have rehearsed a couple of times, and you know, just on a sidebar, it's weird playing songs very sporadically, because I've done reunion things with Watchtower before, but the last one was 20 years ago. The last sort of reunion thing we did, we went to Amstelveen, which is just Amsterdam, and played a festival over there. And we did a couple of warm-up shows around Texas when we before we got on the plane kind of thing. And that was in 2004. So
that's been a while.
What I was going to say is, like, singing songs that you wrote when you 40 years ago.
Yeah.
It's fucking crazy. That's crazy to think about that, you know.
I suppose there's songs you wrote when you were a teenager.
Yeah, and have them be legit, you know, play them and you're like, "Holy shit." And have the, you know, all of the guys look around each other in rehearsal as old men and go, "This shit is fucking hard to play."
Yeah, it's like, why
well, that's
we do
why
this?
People like it. You know, Rush wrote, I'm not comparing us to Rush, but because everyone else does, right? Mm-hmm. They wrote songs that they had to fucking relentlessly rehearse. They wrote songs they could barely play until they could. You know, after show five, it was on. You know, they were, it was like they didn't even have to think about it. So, but to just dabble in it over four decades. Oh, you know, it's a couple shows, you know. Oh, Dangerous Toys, blah, blah, blah. Hey, let's do a reunion show. It's like, fuck. It's kind of weird.
It's pretty cool,
so,
though.
Getting it as tight as you want it to be is hard. So back to, like, how the beginnings of the toys, those guys came in and, you know, I was open to having fun. And that's what it was. It was fun. We weren't looking for a record deal or anything. And so the guy that booked the background, and we played like three bars. We played two bars in Austin, one of them being the back room, which, by the way, side note, next year there is a documentary coming out called Bloody and Bruised, The Untold Story of the Back Room.
Wow.
So that, and we were, you know, I was interviewed for it. All, there's all kinds of bands from around Austin that played there. They did a bunch of reenactments. Like they had these kids like dress up like Dangerous Toys
and
they're backlit so you don't see our faces, but they got my pants right. They got, you know, my hair right. You know,
that's awesome.
That is cool.
It's pretty weird. But anyway, so there, that's, look forward to that. Write that down, everybody. Bloody and Bruised, dot, dot, dot. The Untold Story of the Back Room. Penny Rock Productions is the company that's putting that out. So we played three bars. It was four. That's four bars, and you'll know why I'm saying we played four bars in a second. Two of them in Austin. There was one called Steamboat, and then the Back Room. And then in San Antonio, which is only an hour down the road, it was Sneakers and this place called Rockers. Sometimes we'd play two really long sets, you know, and it was, you know, the regular AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, but then we did, you know, the new wave. We did Pussycat and LA Guns and GNR, and that's not really anything different than what they were doing with Onyx either. So, but we had this new band name, and they had me, and we were just rolling around on the weekends playing covers in these four bars, and we every other weekend or almost every weekend, and it was fun. And then I started this journey in 1987, October of 1987. In March of 1988, we played the second ever South by Southwest Music Conference. So pause for a second. You guys heard of this conference before?
Of course. It's huge.
Okay, so now it's fucking massive, and it's like a three-week detail, and it's a trade show for business. Like Metallica played there because they had that video game coming out,
yeah.
Guitar Hero Metallica or whatever it was. So back to 1988, and it happens every spring break, March of 88. Thank you, Rockin' Pod, for getting me the hell out of town during fucking South by Southwest, because it is murder. You can't park, and all the prices go up. Hotels, parking, through the fucking roof. It's terrible. Okay, rant over. So anyway, we had never heard of it. Like I said, it was 88. It was the second ever South by. And so the guy that booked the Back Room was like, kind of our acting agent, I guess. Jim Ramsey, rest his soul. He's on the phone and he's like, hey, I know you guys just played Friday night and packed it and it was killer, but there's this music conference in town called South by Southwest, and we're yawning on the other end of the phone. And he's like, hungover probably. And then he's like, tomorrow, it's a Sunday night, and there's a slot open in this festival, and I want you guys to play it. And you only have to play 30 minutes, and blah. And we're like looking at him like he's fucking nuts. Go, we just packed it Friday night. You want us to play twice the same weekend? I don't understand it. On a Sunday night? What right in their head rock and roller goes out on a Sunday night? Blah, blah. They got to get up at 6 a.m. and take out the garbage, you know, and that's their job. So he kept explaining and we didn't care, bad attitude. We end up doing it. So it's a Sunday night at the Back Room. We just played there in front of, you know, 600 people. And he's like, you know, 30-minute set. And we played covers. We played like, you know, a handful of original songs. Tease and Pleasin' might have been one of them. Outlaw might have been one of them. I don't even think we had Sportin' a Woody yet. Maybe. It was early. That's early. Yeah. Game. That's early in our game, you know, when you think about the foray. So we played 30 minutes. It was like 15 people in the club. And we still didn't know what the hell. South by what? We still didn't
know. Yeah, you're like, why are we doing this?
Yeah, we did. Bad attitude. I think I was drinking on singing with a beer bottle. You know, we were not on top of our game because we had this bad attitude about it. I mean, I guess we played okay. we're not a very good band, in my opinion. I think that's people like that. People like this kind of loose rock and roll, bad attitude, you know. Yeah. I mean, whatever. I'm too close to it, right? So, and I was probably cursing. That's shit. It was just shit attitude. So we're done with our little set. Maybe two people at the front of the stage. I love you. You know, they saw us Friday. I can't believe you're playing again. You know, it's like never went to sleep from Friday night. And the rest of it was just like, who the hell are these people? So we get off and the guys are in the back schlepping some gear out. And I'm standing over against the wall because there's not really like a dressing room or anything. It's like you got a stage and then you got the wall and then you got the back door and that's it. It's an alley where you load. And I'm leaning against a wall. Not on my phone because cell phones did not exist.
Right.
This lady, Celine Armbeck from SBK Songs, which was a publishing company, approaches me and introduces herself and says, I love you guys. You guys were great. I would love to sit down with you guys and talk about a publishing deal. And my mouth is agape. I'm like, what? My reaction was, I'm not in this band. I'm in this thrash band called Watchtower, and I'm just a fill-in. But if you want to go talk to those guys, they're right there. They're literally 6 feet away. Just that's Tim and that's Mark and that's, you know, just go talk to them. And so she did. So it was kind of like I kind of was a dick. Well, probably not, but I was short with her, right? And so she's like, okay, well, thanks, great set. And I was like, wow, thanks, okay. Goes over there. I didn't even think about it. I didn't think twice about it. Weren't looking to do anything like that. Not even on my mind. I'm the singer for Watchtower. Yeah. I get a call the next day, and it was Mark. He goes, hey, man, that lady was legit. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah.
Wow.
And I'm like, holy shit. So in the meantime, a friend of mine named Julie Hillen had a cassette tape of Dangerous Toys playing live on the radio. It was recorded on a cassette radio boombox. There's this thing in KLBJ is the rock radio station in Austin. They've been around forever. It used to be album rock, kind of been around forever. They had this show called Local Licks. Well, it was called Local Licks Live. And they would mic up a band and you'd play. Well, we did it ours at the back room. So it was easy. It was just like a normal, regular gig. And it was really early on when I was working with the Toys. And I think I went by a different name and the DJ was going around the room like, hey, man, what's your name? And, you know, hi, I'm Mark Geary, play drums, Dangerous Toys. Hey, what's your name? I think I said, my name is Andy Luck and I'm the singer.
Andy Luck?
Andy Luck. Like
Andy Luck lightly?
Have you had any luck lately? Like any luck? Andy Luck.
Oh, boy.
Andy Luck. I think for a second I called myself Billy Boy. My first name is William. Well, see, they were dressed up like Poison I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So I went into it kicking and screaming. I was like, I ain't dressing like that. Fuck that. You know? And they were like, well, let us tease your hair up. Let's get you looking like a maniac. And I go, all right. So I wore like bullet belts and combat boots and I look like fucking rogue male. Remember that? Leather vest and just, I look like the road warrior, but I had my hair looked like a bomb went off on top of my head. And there's some pictures out there floating around. Please don't Google them.
Oh, I totally am.
For a very short time, we were pretty fucking glammed out and very much like I sort of was playing a character, you know, and that might have been Andy Luck.
Yeah.
So anyway, this live recording, and then on the other side was an 87 demo, four songs of Watchtower, and they were studio recordings on one cassette. Julie Hillen mailed that to Los Angeles to a management company called Tapco Entertainment. And I knew that she had done that, but I had no judgment. I didn't care either way. And then And then this South by Southwest thing happened. So it might have been a week earlier that this management company had received this tape. I'm getting my timeline off maybe by a week or two, but it happened fast. So let's say Tim Heine from Tapco Entertainment hears our, and this, that story goes like this. Imagine, if you will, the old mogul type desk management office, and you've got this cool desk, and you've got just stacks of demo tapes that he or she has received. It was exactly like that in my mind. Imagine the brick cell phone with the curly Q wire in some early 80s Corvette, and it's 1988, and you're a manager, and you manage, and this is true, he managed Y&T, he managed Keel, there's a bunch of other. He ended up with Rat and Cinderella as well. But, wow. So Tim Heine, badass. He's a badass. So we didn't realize all of these things because it was just a phone call that resulted from Julie, my friend, sending this tape out there. And he pops in the tape driving on the 101, out driving back out to Ventura where he lived. And he pulled the car over and got the phone out, and he's like, called his office, and he's like, find out who the fuck this is. He heard Tease and Pleasin' on that live. The first song, Tease and Pleasin'. And he stopped and called. And I think it was the kind of thing where Tim would, if he didn't like it, he would hit eject and chuck it out on out of the window on the highway. In my fantasy brain,
right. That's what
don't mess with California. You know, don't throw tapes on the road. Don't litter. Well,
back in those days, there were probably a lot of tapes on the road.
yeah. So I've seen a few tapes crushed on the highway before. So I usually pick them up, make sure they're not mine. So anyway, the wheels were rolling whether we wanted them to or not. So he called his office and found out, you know, and then we heard from Julie, hey, man, he really dug that. And the first thing out of my mouth was, did he listen to the Watchtower side?
Wow, yeah.
Right.
He didn't even get to it. And I was like, damn it, you're supposed to rewind it. Side A, rewind Watchtower. I don't know. It's not, she didn't do anything wrong. If anything, she helped.
Right.
But then the South By thing was about to help it explode. Celine Armbeck from SBK Songs Publishing Company, which later turned into a record label, but that's a little bit of another story. We said, well, have you ever heard of Tapco Entertainment, to Celine? You know, she's like, no, what's that? We go, well, you guys are both in Los Angeles and you guys don't know each other. You guys need to go have a coffee. So we gave each other their numbers, and they hooked up in Los Angeles that week, and they got together for dinner or something. And they said, wow, we should do something with this. Let's put our heads together and set some stuff up. So very quickly they said, so we're going to offer, you know, Tapco Entertainment offered us a management deal and said, roughly within 90 days, that's 3 months. Within 90 days, basically, if we can secure a full-on record deal for you, I own your ass.
Yeah.
And in 90 days, I do not secure a, you know, substantial record deal, we shake hands and we leave the ring. It's over. And we looked at each other and we really got nothing to lose. Who's going to sign this piece of shit? You know, because we were so young and green, and even though I had a little bit of experience and had a record or two out by then, and that doesn't matter. You don't know shit just because I've been in the recording studio. Yay me. Yeah. You don't know shit. So I was 21. So I think I had turned 22 that March of 88. So we say, fuck it. And we sign it. And I have to tell the Watchtower guys about it. And they were not pleased. And I said, I'll let you know if anything further happens. And they were like, God damn it. And I was like, I know, God damn it. This kind of sucks, but it's a big what if, right? So I tried not to think about it too heavy. And they started setting up showcases. We showcased for all of the major labels. This is before any merger had ever happened. This is in 1988, April, May, June, July. We at the back room, we showcased in our hometown, in our the club we pretty much owned, and they came to us and they wined and dined us, and all of them said the same thing: "You guys are great, man. Gonna be the next Guns N' Roses," and you know whatever they said.
Yeah.
I have red hair and tattoos, and I sing real high. It was weren't hiding it, holding it back. That's where the industry was kind of headed, because Appetite broke. Finally broke. That record's from like 86, right. Early 87, and it finally broke.
Yeah.
Took a year or so, right? But and I had already seen them play a couple times. Saw them in a club headline, and I saw them open for the Cult on the Electric tour.
Nice.
And they were badass. It was like seeing a punk band back then.
Right.
Raw. They were pissed. Bad attitude. Late. Starting songs over, whatever. It was fucking awesome just to see that rawness, you know. Anyway, it happened. We ended up going with Columbia, and that's where the wheels start rolling even faster. So I have to leave Tower, and then I'm trying to help them, and then I'm also packing my bags because we have to pick a producer. We ended up with Max Norman. He produced this song. What's that song? Crazy Train. You guys are
ready? Yeah.
He's an absolute legend. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, apparently he was a big deal. No, I love Max. And of course I was familiar with his work. Jesus Christ. He helped us really get where the band needed to be, because he told the truth. He worked us like horses.
Yeah, I was going to ask if he was a taskmaster and really stayed on you.
Yeah, he was like, "You can do better." Again, and I'll go, "That was 50 takes. I'm getting tired." Yeah, fuck that. Again. Okay.
So when you say you had to choose a producer, was Max Norman like in a pool of guys that were offered to you?
Well, it wasn't, since it was our first record, and maybe the label had already worked with him and thought he would be good, and his name sort of rung a bell with us. Yes and no, but the idea behind all that, like for the second record, Hellacious, there was definitely a pool of, it was a short list of names, and we even went to dinner with a few of them and ended up with Roy. But nothing against Roy Thomas Baker. He's a legend. Yeah. He did that band. Let's see, what are they called? Queen.
Yeah.
I have to laugh because my life is a dream.
Right.
So we probably should have gone with Max a second for continuity, because right. I really think he would have brought the songs out a little better. Or he would have said, "You guys ain't ready yet. You need to go back in the garage and write about 8 more good songs." And he would have been right, in my opinion. About Hellacious, not to dawn on that, but Hellacious is like half cooked. Like half the songs are really good. Best of Friends, Give Me No Lip, Gunfighter, Sugar, maybe one more. Line them up. And then there's the other. You know, one's a cover song, which was, a lot of people love that cover. The Bad Company, Feel Like Making Love. Anyway, so I was packing my bags. We were going to Los Angeles to record in the infamous Sound City Studios, which we had never heard of before.
Right.
Because we had forgotten, you know, when you're reading the backs of your record collection and you see Sound City, it doesn't really, the studio, I need to know where they recorded this record. It wasn't really, you know, what kind of guitars does Paul Stanley use? What, you know, where was this live album recorded, you know? You're reading, and then you just read it again over and over, like, you know, your favorite comic book, right? Yeah. That's kind of what it was. So Sound City eventually came back to me when I was in the studio walking around looking at all the sales awards hanging on the wall, like, Out of the Cellar was it?
Yeah.
Fucking Tusk was recorded here. You know, what? Holy Diver?
Holy
you
Diver.
Know, shit like that starts coming to you, and you're like, what the fuck? You know, anyway, so Legendary Studio, had a blast. Max worked our asses off. But the pre-game festivities were, there was a rehearsal in the lot across the parking lot from Sound City. There was a little rehearsal place you could do some pre-production.
Yeah, I was going to talk to you about that because we had Vinny Appice on like a year or so ago, and he talking about the making of Holy Diver, and so, some of his funniest memories were doing the rehearsal stuff in that building, and then him and Ronnie and Jimmy Bain and them trying to wheel all their stuff across the parking lot to go record the stuff.
Yeah, so it's obviously a legendary parking lot.
Yeah.
Right.
I was happy because it was this skateboard company called Skull Skates right next to the rehearsal place, which is still across the parking lot from Sound City. And they actually gave me a skateboard because I was in there all the time going, yeah, this shit's cool, man. And I bought a shirt or something. Here, just take this deck. I remember it well. I wish I still had it. It was stolen. Mm-hmm. And it was called Dead Guys. So on the bottom of the deck, the artwork was like screen prints of Elvis and Jim Morrison and, you know, dead guys, dead Sid guys. Vicious, and it was pretty cool. It's pretty rad. But yeah, those rehearsals really helped us a lot because Scared, we had started writing before we got on the plane back in Austin. Tin Boots as well was brand new. Scared, Tin Boots, Queen of the Nile was new. Outlaw Teasing, Woody, Trouble. Like I said, Trouble was... that was the first song that I wrote with those guys. Anyway, so yeah, we had pre-production. Like, here's some fly on the wall stuff. So imagine Max kind of visiting the room, you know, every once an hour, you know, coming in and going, play this one for me. And yeah, we need it, you know, Scared. We play Scared, and we would just start it. And you know how it starts with the vocal right away.
It's a strange beginning for a song.
Yeah, that was Max's idea because we were coming in with an intro. You know, we had like a formula we liked. We ended up going with Max's idea because it was like, boom, you know, just verse right away. And it was like, and that backward sort of cymbal thing, kind of he created that. That was his idea because it kind of was, you know, how we do it live is 1, 2, 3, boom, vert, you know, and that's fine. You know, fans are ready to sing that. They don't care how you start it. Tin Boots, the halftime, I call it the mosh part. That thing. That wasn't in there. It wasn't played halftime. It was played straight. The whole song was. So it was my idea. Well, let's play a halftime there, and it'll give everybody a break because you know the whole song is bang 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 bang, right? You know, and that worked, and Max liked that. But there were a few things like that sort of just needed more eyes on it. We didn't work these out in the pre-production, but wherever they were, there were these like holes, like especially in Tin Boots, where you got a little intro, and then you got a yee-haw, and then the solo thing, and then you got a verse, and then there's a bit, and then there's a verse, and then there's a bit. Well, he'd stop the tape when we're actually tracking, and he'd say shit like, "You've got this big fucking hole right here. You need to put something in there." That's a terrible Max Norman, but he's English, so I'm just trying. He made Scott put all these like little shreddy things between the verses, and it really kept the song alive, like awake, you know, like kept it moving. And I was like, wow, okay. And so we just started to do that anywhere that as needed in all of the songs. And so that we learned a lot from taking the lashes from Max.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. So I still use what I learned from Max in every project and every song, any song I'm writing. I don't care if it's a country song, a Christmas song. I use the knowledge, that the things I learned. So that's pretty much how that all kind of came together.
Yeah, because once it happens, man, they strap a rocket to you guys. I mean, you got Max Norman. I mean, just look at the credits on this thing. So you got Max Norman, produce, engineers, and mixes. And then it's mastered by Bob Ludwig. And, I mean, for a debut album, that's some pretty impressive stuff. So they're putting a lot behind you guys.
Yeah, we were in this is, I'm not, you know, beating myself up here when I say we're a new band.
Yeah.
No one knows who we are. In March of the same year, we're recording this record. We were like, look, you drinking a beer, playing a cover song.
It's wild.
So that's just crazy. A few months later, we're, what? I'm in California. What? I'm going to the Cat House and every bar on the Sunset Strip that you read about or heard about or, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to get your memory of the Sunset Strip during that era, because we were too young to experience it and we were both living out of state. So was it as amazing being on that strip at the time as I've heard?
It was like Bourbon Street, you know, Fat Tuesday. It was like Sixth Street on the weekends here in Austin, but every night. And everyone, it was a fashion show. Everyone's dressed up. Everyone's passing out flyers. It was oversaturated. A bit ridiculous. And you could see famous singers and guitar players holding court on different corners, like all night long. Like I ran into David Lee Roth. Well, not ran into him, but he's literally, the lights are off. They're standing in front of the rainbow. With they is like an Amazon blonde, to be straight, not very good looking. But just look like a wrestler, total Amazon, raw, you know, look like a wig, just blonde, just platinum hair out to here. Was probably some kind of somebody. Was probably somebody that worked at a bar, or had a show, or you know, their own show. Could have been in a band, but it was just some crazy big lady, and David Lee Roth, and then his bodyguard, just a big dude. And there's a limo parked there, of course. And they're just shooting the shit, and it's dark. But I realize as I walk past, that's David Lee Roth. And I have a little point-and-shoot 135 camera in my pocket. Because I'm a kid from Texas, never been anywhere, blah, blah, blah. Actually, I had been to Los Angeles before, but not on the Sunset Strip. I was out hanging with some friends and who were in the, you know, closer to the scene that I was part of with Watchtower. Gene Hoagland, Dark Angel, Testament, yeah, Death.
Amazing drummer.
Keep going. Yeah. Amazing person. Yes. Michelle Meldrum, who's passed away, played in Phantom Blue, played in a band with Gene Hoagland called War God before he joined Dark Angel. Mm. Basically Phantom Blue kinda turned into what is now the Iron Maidens, because Linda McDonald was in Phantom Blue. Anyway, so that would have been in 87, like summer 87, late 86. Yeah, 86, 87. I had been out there a couple times, but not in this capacity, not in this scenario.
So did you take a picture of Dave?
I went up to David Lee Roth, and I looked up at who was obviously his handler, and they were laughing and having a great time in the dark under the porch. The porch lights is out. It's late night, like late. And I looked up at him, and I was like, do you mind? And he was like, didn't even break conversation with, they're laughing. He's in the middle of a laugh, and he's like, get out of here, kid.
Oh,
get out of here, kid. And I was like, bummer. And I said, well, can I at least shake Dave's hand? He's like, Dave just put out his hand like royalty. So I kissed the ring. Not literally, but I shook a limp, you know, care. I'm get out of here, kid. You know, kind of a thing. No one was rude.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, once I'm nice to you, then everyone else who's walking by is going to come over here and, you know.
Right.
Flies to shit, and, you know.
You were probably the 150th person that had come up to him that
day. At least I wasn't bum rushing them. I tiptoed into their situation. And I said, it's probably not cool to take a picture, but I walked away and then I backed up and went click and kind of, I might have run like a kid. And it was dark. There was no flash. So you could kind of, I don't have the picture anymore, but I printed it. I knew it was David Lee Roth. I didn't care what anybody else said. Look, it's my picture, right. David Lee Roth. That's an underexposed shit. That could be anybody. I mean, yeah, it was, the strip was kind of crazy. Too many bands, so much going on.
So at the time you're there, I mean, are you guys known in the scene? Because are you coming in like outsider, or that nobody knows who you are, or they
That's
treat
exactly
you like
it.
Shit? Or...
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
No one knows who we are. We were going to the cat house, basically telling people if we wanted to get any treatment, we would have to like beg, because no one knew who we were.
Yeah.
But in the, if there were industry people out there that everyone else knew, it was easier for us because there was a hint of red carpet, because they were able to lean in to the door person and go, hey, I've got my boys here. They're signed to Columbia. We just picked them up and they're going to be happening. The shit's great. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, that's cool. Hey, nice to meet you guys. So there was a lot of that. And then a year later, it was like, come on in, ah, you know. So, yeah, we were no one when we went out there. But we were going to the cat house, and you could see Axl, and you could see, you know, members of Pussycat everywhere. And Ricky Rackman was just a club DJ kind of a guy. He was a business owner, right? I saw Ricky Rackman's band play.
Oh, yeah?
Saw him sing. He had a band called Virgin. He'll be the first one to tell you that they weren't very good, but I love Ricky because he's like that. He's honest and straight and loud and wears his heart on his sleeve and tells you what he thinks and tells you the truth. So yeah, it was interesting. There was that going on, and this was during the recording, and there were some nights that I knew that I had a big studio day where I wouldn't go out, but we were young and stupid, so we went out all the time. There were moments where I was so tired. I mean, we would burn all night. Like, I would get back to my apartment at like 3-4 in the morning, just like, what's my name? You know, but it was, I wouldn't have changed a bit anything. Because it was a learning experience. It was kind of, I was living a very fast dream as a young rocker. And it was kind of cool. And I'll never forget it. And I'm glad that some of us had these shitty little cameras, because I still have the photos of us just hanging out at you know, Sound City and what have you. And, you know, going to the Rainbow with Max Norman, because people knew him there.
Let me ask you a couple things about some of the songs. I was never a lyrics person growing up, so I never really delved into what lyrics were. But, and then just recently I realized that Scared is actually a tribute to Alice Cooper, with several, you know, references to his songs in there. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that you grew up a big fan of his.
Well, I feel like as much as anybody, I mean, I can't remember the first time I actually had albums by Alice, but I had a couple of 45s. That's how old Alice is.
Yeah.
Didn't mean for it to come out that way. But so I'm a kind of a child, mid-70s anyway, what, 10, 11, 12? And I have Alice Cooper 45 records, you know. School's out. No More Mr. Nice Guy, I Never Cry, 18, stuff like that. And I had Kiss and Queen 45s too, but I had Kiss and Queen albums.
Did you ever have a chance to talk to Alice about the song?
Yes. And he appreciated that very much. The truth is, and you'll hear it here, not first, because I've said this before, but the truth is that I was on a huge Alice kick during this late 80s time. I had picked up a bunch of vinyl and was back on this resurgence of Alice. But in the 70s, when I was young, as I started to say earlier, it's true that I would go to the skating rink and they would play Bee Gees and Kiss and Elton and Alice Cooper and Queen and, you know, Bye Bye Miss American Pie. You know, they all that AM Gold, which all of the bands were on AM radio, AM Gold. It was Beth and Detroit and Rock and Roll All Night and 18 and School's Out and Saturday Night Fever and Shadow Dancing and you know, all that old early soul and funk and hard rock and what proto metal they would play at the skating rink. And I was like, this is the greatest thing. This is the greatest time to be alive. I was a fan of Alice as probably as much as I was anybody else. But I had a lot, you know, like I've already fessed up. I had Queen and Kiss and Elton coming out of my ears. So as far as record collection. So to fast forward to me writing the lyrics for Scared, I was on this big Alice kick. So Mama's Lace and Whiskey, stop. Lace and Whiskey, that's an album title. There's a lyric somewhere. I can't remember what song it is, but in the whisper part, in the breakdown of Scared, I say, why are these bones on the floor? And then I say, for some odd reason, I say burgundy and white. And I swear those are from, I'm plagiarizing. Those are from Alice lyrics. Somehow, some way, that's imagery, right?
Roses on white lace.
Yeah, could have been, but there's something. There's a lyric it might be on a song on Killer. I can't remember, where he uses the line burgundy and white.
Oh, okay.
Describing the color of something, which could be blood on lace. Burgundy and white, that's what that sounds like. Sounds like spilt wine to me, but yeah. So that's what I love about Alice, is he's able to paint pictures and take you into a movie that you don't have to watch. It's audible, right?
Yeah. Incredible lyricist, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The biggest one that no one ever gets or seems to just miss is the very first line in the song, "Who is the man in the white vest?" I got to get out of here. It's a straight jacket. The white vest, Ballad of Dwight Frye, was a big one for me.
Dwight Frye, yeah.
Yeah.
Love that song.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's in a padded room and wearing a white vest, a straight jacket. Yeah.
I got to get out of here.
Yeah. So, you know, why do I like this? Why do I like being scared? Why am I here? What's going on? Oh, let's crank the crank on the Jack in the Box and boom. Oh, shit. Oh, I'll put the clown back in and do it again. You must like it. So the song is built off of all of that stuff. And then some of the other songs, Take Me Drunk, I'm Home. That's a stupid bumper sticker in a,
yeah, truck stop. Yeah.
That's a truck stop. But we did that all the time. You know, lyrically, you know, I think Sportin' the Woody is a saying that a friend of mine was emulating that he saw in a movie. It might have been in Short Circuit. The Sportin' the Woody. Somebody said that, and I was like, what the fuck is that? So once I realized, it's like, oh shit, that's a title. That's gonna be easy. That song wrote itself, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Why was there no video for that song?
There wasn't a video for what? Sporting a Woody? Well, it's a song about dicks, I guess, if Aerosmith can do...
I guess I answered my own question.
I guess if Aerosmith would have made a video for 10-inch record...
Big 10-inch?
I mean, yeah, the and then ZZ Top with... shit, Pearl Necklace. They got it all. Yeah, Slip Inside My Sleeping Bag...
Yeah.
Tube Snake Boogie.
Tube Snake. There you go. Tube Snake Boogie and Sportin' a Woody and my big 10 inch. That's obvious. Those are things that, you know, maybe videos shan't be made of.
Yeah. And that's a song too that takes me back, because I'm still pretty young. I'm still living with my parents and I'm listening to all this music. And there'd be some songs like, oh, don't let the parents catch me listening to this one. Or you giggle when you listen to it. I'm the Man by Anthrax. You know, me and my buddies always felt like we were getting away with something by listening to that. Or Wasted Rock Ranger by Great White was another one that you'd always kind of like giggle at and be like, don't let the adults hear you listening to this. Sportin' a Woody, music by horny young dudes for horny young dudes.
Sure.
I loved it.
And girls too.
Yeah.
They loved that song.
Yeah.
So that's it. And like the big Vikings, the, you know, nowadays you at a Dangerous Toy Show, you see the big like tattooed biker looking guys with long beards, you know, they don't have any hair anymore. So they grow it on their face and that's fine. That will be me soon, probably. So the point is that I'm making is they know all the words to the ballads. They know all the words to Queen of the Nile. They sing Queen of the Nile with me.
I was wondering why that was never a single, because that has radio play written all over it.
Ironically, there was a single for Sportin' a Woody, and this is so stupid, but they edited the word shitty. Those women in the city that make me feel shitty. So the word shitty, they had the women in the city that make me feel, you know, it's totally stupid. And then there was a version, Women of the City Make Me Feel Beep, where they beeped it out. And it was just, I was like, what? This is, who cares? What? So I laughed at the label. I was like, you really think that this is worth doing these edited versions and just so you can make this song a single? Their argument was, dude, it's a fun little boogie woogie song. People love this song. And I go, well, I get that. And I can be proud in that extent. But for you to go beyond art form and fuck with it just to get it somewhere else that you think it's going to, and it didn't really fly. It was a CD world. So there's not really a B side, but it was the B side of Queen of the Nile. They did try to push Queen of the Nile as a single, but it was late in the game. Like Teasing and Scared had done a lot of damage, and that's all people had. I mean, anything else that came, radio tried, and it, I mean, they still played. I mean, everybody was still playing, you know, deep cuts, in my opinion, I'll just call them deep cuts, off of that record. And they were Queen of the Nile and Sportin' a Woody, but Queen of the Nile lyrics, came from an obsession that I had with, I still have somewhat, with Egyptian folklore. Mm-hmm. The pharaohs and Cleopatra and the sphinxes, and almost like mixed with sort of like spells and, you know, their the tombs and all the gold and the idols and the masks and the, you know, and I thought it was beautiful that they were so glammed up. their religious beliefs were so glammed up, you know, everything's gold and painted, and they buried everybody with food and wine and gold, you know, and you know, crosses and, you know, talisman, and, you know, it's, they were serious about it. So that lyric kind of comes and it spins on the Cleopatra thing. But do you guys remember the George Michael video, Father Figure?
Oh, sure.
You remember the model that was in the video that had the Cleopatra haircut? That helped me go, oh, wait, it's Cleopatra's thing, you know. Yes, I'm a George Michael fan. Yes, I'm a Wham fan. So every time that video would come in, I would watch it, and that was sort of somewhat of a weird inspiration. If it wasn't, I wouldn't have brought it up, but that tied in with the stuff I was into already was kind of helped me create that storyline. And I love those lyrics. It's probably some of the best lyrics I've ever written. And if you notice, I'd feel like the rhyme scheme is kind of weird. It doesn't really,
it's weird.
Not all of them rhyme. Not all of those lines rhyme. And I left it, and it was based on audible emotion instead of actual rhymes.
That's pretty cool. I always liked that one. Another song on the album I like that we haven't really talked about yet, it's got such an awesome groove to it, it's one of my favorites on here, is Feels Like a Hammer.
Mm. Yeah, love that song.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I'm not putting words in anyone's mouth here, because I saw it every night. When we were on tour with The Cult, we would play that song. And then eventually we dropped any kind of ballad from our show. And Queen of the Nile was the only sort of, and Queen's not really a ballad, but it's very on, it's light in the pants. You know, it's just, it's heavy enough, but it's still, the melody is major and it's kind of happy and it's, you know what I mean? It's catchy.
Yeah.
There you go. But we were on the Cult tour. We were playing Feels Like a Hammer, like every night. Queen was in there too. I can't remember what songs we weren't playing because we only had 40 minutes of music anyway. It was our first album, right? Ian Asprey from the Cult be on the side of the stage over here. So I'd be facing the audience, and like corner of my eye, I'd, oh shit, Ian's over there watching us every night sing that song. Love that song. Reason, I don't know there be a true reason as to why that didn't become a single. I mean, dude, you guys keep bringing up songs. They can't all be singles.
Well, I mean, yeah, but, you know, you got to have some tracks that are a little bit deeper that are awesome, and I just think that's one of them. They don't all have to be singles. I just think they're great songs.
I appreciate that, but, it, you know, there were other outside people who had my respect. I don't know why that's not a single, you know. I wasn't pointing at you guys.
No, Paula Salvatore is listed as the backing vocals on that song. Who is that?
Yeah, that is the receptionist at Sound City.
No kidding.
Wow.
Yeah. Max had done a lot of records there, and they were friends. But she's a singer, and I believe she's the manager now at Sound City, like the new refurbished Sound City Studios. I think she's the property manager there now.
That's cool.
And she's in the business, you know, she's in the record business. So she's a performer as well. Fairly recently, you know where it was? It was at Rockin' Pod. Someone walked up to me and showed me the Toys CD, and it had Paula's autograph on it.
Oh, really?
They had run into her somewhere and figured out who it was, put two and two together, and brought it up, and holy shit, you know, and had her sign it. And she was like, what? That's crazy. You know, and she may have forgotten all about it. Maybe not. Who knows? But at Rockin' Pod, somebody came up to me and had a Paula Salvatore story. So,
yeah, only at Rockin' Pod are you going to get that.
Yeah, it was, well, Nerds Unite. That's great. Yeah, that's another great thing about Rockin' Pod. Me and Mike harmonized really great. Mike Watson, bass player, harmonized really great together on everything. Scared, you know, all anything in there, on there, it's me and Mike. And he's a great writer. He wrote the lyrics for Gimme No Lip, and that's on the second record, but he wrote Best of Friends, also second record. But on the first record, he wrote lyrics for Tin Boots. There's more, or I'm just going blank. So Max is like, why don't we try getting a different vocal on here, like something that's just a bit of a different timbre and color, and you know, that way it'll give it a slightly different spin. So he got Paula in there, and she ripped on the chorus a couple of times, and that's all it needed. And Mike Watson is still in there, but there's like a three-part harmony now on that chorus that's not there when it was ever played live after that. So in the studio, there's actually a three-part instead of a two-part. But that's who that is.
That's cool. Such an epic sounding chorus. It's so big sounding. That's what I love about it.
I love those chords. Yeah. Scott's really good at those weird kind of climbing staircase sus chord shit. And those are in Scared. Those are in Queen of the Nile. They're all over the record. I think he got it from this guy, Eddie Van Halen. You heard of him?
I think I've heard of him.
He got some of that stuff from this other guy, Warren DeMartini. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They use that a lot. Eddie and Warren do that a lot. George Lynch does too.
Right. I was just going to say that.
Yeah. So, and I think it fit. Those were the guys of the time. And that's, you know, Scott loves Tony Iommi, you know, but as far as getting busy on the guitar, he likes to get busy on the guitar. So those guys were staying busy and still being colorful without masturbation.
No, it's good stuff. Another thing I always think about when I think about Dangerous Toys in general, and especially this album, you guys got an album with some pretty iconic album art on it.
Mm.
You know, the logo, the clown who's bright, and then the background's kind of dark and dingy. It really jumps out. It's got like same kind of thing like Iron Maiden, where if somebody had no idea who that was and was just flipping through looking at records, odds are they're going to grab an Iron Maiden album or a Kiss album or this Dangerous Toys album. Do you guys got any say in the artwork, or is that just something that's provided?
That's a good question. So it being our first record, and we're green, and you know, let us figure that out, kid. Get out of here. You know, that never happened. There was a little bit of rub by way of, and no one was doing anything wrong. It was here. The story goes like this. So back in the day, there was these things called fax machines, and
I remember.
The manager, Tim Heine, who was in my stories earlier, was faxing from management office. And I didn't have a fax machine. I had to walk. I didn't have a car. I had to walk to the copy place, you know, half a mile away. Not bad. and go, yeah, you got a fax for me? And they'll, yeah, what's the name? And they just hand you what it faxed, you know.
Wow.
So I'm looking at, and I still have these faxes, by the way. There was this company called the Illusion Factory, these guys have been doing some sketches via discussions that I had had or we had had with management about what is a dangerous toy, what's going on, what are we going to do? We don't have a real logo yet or anything, and this shit's happening fast. And I'm like, what is a dangerous toy? Okay, well, you know, maybe a Jack in the Box, you know, maybe a dildo, maybe a clown dildo, maybe a Jack in the Box dildo.
I don't think that would fly on the record cover.
But... No, but that's where kind of our dirty little minds were planted.
Right.
Dangerous Toys, we were stuck with that fucking name, the label, they liked it, the management, they liked it, we were there, we had to shit or take a walk, right? So we started in with this clown thing, and these faxes had these really cartoony round faced little cute little tiny cowboy hat clown faces, really round and bubbly, that with a little tiny, you know, really cute.
Yeah.
Shit that would be on like baby pajamas and shit.
Oh, God.
In my opinion. Yeah. And yeah. I'm like calling, I'm going, is this a joke? What's going on here? See, I like your knee-jerk reaction, Chris, because you're saying that like you cannot believe that because you're so used to seeing this maniac.
Oh, yeah, that's
clown.
True.
Right. So
yeah.
So if you go back to the beginning where there's absolutely zilch to think or have, because there is nothing, you're pulling shit out of the air. And so are they in their defense, the Illusion Factory and my manager. And I'm like, this is terrible. No, there's no way in hell. I don't even want to use this artist anymore. And they're like, These are the best artists in the business. This company does, they're artists, and this company does promotionals for everybody and everything out for in the business. And I'm like, well, you know, let's have a party for them, but they ain't going to draw my fucking album cover. And he's like, I said, and before he could retort, I said, I got a guy in San Antonio right now that tomorrow can come up with a sketch, it'll, you know, not full color, but a sketch that'll blow this into oblivion and you won't even remember what this looked like. May I proceed? He goes, there's no way that you can do that. And I go, will you give me a chance? Yeah, okay, we'll see. Total doubting me. Got the drawing. Oh, I know what it was. I think I called my buddy Tommy Pons down in San Antonio, and he drew this fucking thing. And I think I gave him the fax number. And I said, fuck it, just fax it. I go, can you describe it to me? And it's like, he's got fangs, and he's, you know, this scary-ass eyes. Originally, his eyes were whited out, like Cotton Eye Joe. There's no pupils. There's just white. So it was fucking freaky looking.
Is this the sketch that's inside the sleeve?
No.
No, that's not the one?
No.
Okay.
No. It's online. You can find it. I think it's got a bullseye backdrop. It's like a purple and red, maybe purple and white circle bullseye thing with the clown over it. And he's got crossbones. And his eyes are white, and he's drooling, and he's got really like alien, you know, H.R. Giger fangs dripping.
Oh, wow.
But it's the clown. It's our clown. You can tell.
Right.
Yeah.
You'll find it. You'll go, oh, that must be it. And he described it to me. I go, well, that sounds killer. I don't even remember seeing his sketch. And I think he just went ahead and faxed it. Me talking to Tommy on the phone, just fax it to this guy. And if they like it, then there will be some revisions and you'll be doing our album cover. And he was like, hot dog. So the rest is history. obviously the original version got dumbed down slightly. The teeth were a little edge, you know, got an edge put on them instead of them because they were like needles. It was freaky looking. And then the eyes had the rainbow kind of pupil. And then we had to think about, well, he's a Jack in the Box. And then we used to have our walk on music, Toys in the Attic by Aerosmith. You know, in the attic. And so that was on our minds all the time because we heard that song all the time. You know, one of the greatest rock and roll boogie woogie numbers ever written.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like, you know, it was our dessert all the time. So that was in my head. And I was like, well, this background can be like he's in a room in a box, you know, locked up in the attic, forgotten about because he's in asylum because he's a maniac. And if you look, there's like etches on the wall, like how many days he's been in there kind of thing. And the rest is history. That's how that happened. Did you guys ever see those promotional Jack in the Boxes?
I saw you pull one out on an interview you did like a year ago.
Yeah. If you'll let me, I can do that. Yeah. I can play that game again. Give me a sec. Well, let's hope it doesn't fall apart as I demonstrate here. So,
oh, wow.
This is the Illusion Factory. This is a version of the Illusion Factory for you guys. I know that most you have listeners and maybe not watching this, but you can see how the face is kind of round and balloony.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on a sketch that was from the original, but it worked well for this, I think, because it's archaic looking. It's kind of like a little bit, it's rough edge and it's on all four sides and it's on the lid as well. So this was sent, there was like 200 of these made. Here's the bottom. It's actually in pretty fucking good shape and it's just made of some kind of resin, right? And then stained, I guess. Made to look like wood. It reminds me of the box on Hellraiser.
Yeah, the Hellraiser box. Yeah.
So, which I love. So this was, I think about 200 of these were sent. And just for people listening, it's if you throw the horns and you spread the horns as wide as you can with your hand, that's about how wide the box is.
So did this go out for radio stations?
5 or 6 inches, right? Yes, radio stations, maybe some magazine promos, you know, MTV, whatever. And no one knew of who we were yet. So then they open up a box and they see this shit and they're like, "What the fuck is this?" There's probably a bio and there's a story and it's from Columbia and blah 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 about the band. And so there's a latch here. And I don't want to just like flick it and like, it's a fucking Jack in the Box. There's a clown in here. It's going to go boing, 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 you know. But I don't want to like trust it. It'll blow the hinges off the back. I've already replaced it. I don't know if you can see. I've replaced a couple of the screws. Look, one of these screws is not like the other. Because they were just, those are rivets glued in, I think. So I'm going to gently open this and you'll see. So the cassette would pop out. And the spring in this fucking thing is like a shotgun. So the tape would go, bing. It was not tested. It was not market tested. So this cassette would hit the ceiling. Bing.
People are getting hit in the face with cassette tapes.
Yeah, and there's a little, see the little spring-loaded cassette holder?
Yep. It's
like a little trigger there. There's a spring on that, and then there's a spring under this really terrible-looking clown. with a stupid little cowboy hat, and he's got a hangman's noose. They're trying to make him more sick and menacing by putting a hangman's noose on him, which is a good try. Now, if you look closely, his bottom teeth are kind of gone. They were a little longer, and if you see the teeth on the top, some of them are jagged and longer. So it's fragile. So these teeth, a lot of them had broken off. So obviously
broken teeth.
Yeah, broken teeth. So obviously I had, I like the way you think. So I had, stupid me had a little bit of time one day and I decided, well, I want to put him, give him some more teeth and make him look fucked up, you know? So those are toothpicks. I painted some toothpicks brown and black and yellow, and I shoved them up in there, and I glued them, and then I broke them off. Toothpicks.
It looks like it was made that way.
Yeah, it does. Well, this could have been in their prototype, too, something similar. Anyway, that's that, and a very cool promo item.
Yeah.
If I don't say so myself.
See, again, that's Columbia really taking the time and doing it right with you guys.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, they... between management and the publishing company, and they really cared about, you know, what was about their investment, right?
Yeah.
And we were happy with that. Wow, that's cool. You know, like they didn't tell us they were doing these until later, you know, or until they were already done. They, you know, we saw one and we're like, what the fuck? How come we don't have one of these? And then, you know,
have you ever had a fan bring one up to you to sign or anything?
I was just about to mention some storytelling about this promotional item. Fell on hard times years ago and had to sell off some things, and it happens, right? Happens to everybody. And I sold mine for like $150 online, and sold some of my hair, cut all my hair off in the mid-90s. Like literally had a flat top kind of thing, and sold my hair $150 again. Seemed to be a magic number. Sold my old hat. I don't know if you remember my hat. An old photo said "Hail Bound" on it.
Yep.
Sold that. Sold some boots, cowboy boots I wore in the teasing video, shit like that. Anyway, the Jack in the Box. I sold mine. So I don't know. A couple years later, a friend of mine who played guitar in a punk rock band called Riddlin' Kids, who were under the Sony blanket. Can't remember if they were at, you know, I don't know what label they were on, but it was under the Sony blanket. And he became friendly with some of the reps there. And he was out on the road, and he went to the Sony office, and he walked into his rep's office. "Hey, man, we're on the road playing tonight, and we're nearby. Just wanted to come by and say hi." And he's like, "Yeah, have a seat." He sits down, and this box here that I just showed you guys was on their desk.
Wow.
And he sees it, and he's like, "Holy shit, I know those guys." And they're like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah, they're from Austin." "Oh, really? I don't even know. I just thought it was weird, and it's on here. You want to give it to him? That would be awesome." And he's like, "Holy shit, really?" So he takes it. He's on the road with it in his suitcase. He shows up to, ironically, a Broken Teeth show. And he walks up to me and he goes, "Dude," and presents it to me. And then I proceed to tell, I'm shocked. And he tells me the story, and I proceed to tell him the story I just told you about hard times. I sold mine. I needed money. So obviously the universe, if you believe that stuff, wants me to have one.
That's wild.
As it should be.
Can't make that shit up.
No, you can't.
That's so awesome. Well, then, if we're talking about the artwork in the album, got to talk about the photograph on the back taken by legendary photographer Mark Weiss.
Yep.
Got to hang out with him a little bit at Rockin' Pod. Where's it taken? And tell us a story about the photo shoot that day.
There's a place called Sunset Valley, which is technically just South Austin. Sunset Valley, I think we give credit in the record, Sunset Valley. I think we, thanks to Sunset Valley, there was, it's not there anymore, but there was this old stable kind of goat corral kind of a thing. And there might've been a, you know, a tin barn structure on it, and it was overgrown. And I always eyeballed it every time I drove by it, because I was like, man, that's weird seeing this, you know, big city, and then in the middle of nowhere, there's this plot of land that obviously someone's holding on to for big money. And, it's kind of in a neighborhood. There's residential nearby, because I was living literally just a mile away, like 1 mile away. And it could have been Mark. During that, on that day, saying like, "Well, hey, what, you know, do you got any locations we could go to? I don't know. You know, I don't know where to go. And it's like, oh, there might be a couple places. There's this one place. And at first thing that came out of my brain was this little horse stable looking place that's right up the road. And I tried to tell him where it was, and I couldn't tell him where it was. I go, if you turn down this street is named blah, blah, blah. You just turn, you can't fucking miss it. You'll be driving down a residential, and then all of a sudden there's this big plot of land next to a football stadium, or you know, it's a high school stadium kind of thing. But there's this plot of land in between residential and this football stadium with a huge giant parking lot that this is adjacent to, connected to kind of thing. That's it. He goes, meet you there in an hour. I called all the boys. We all knew where it was. We're all living close by. Went over there. Hi, I'm Mark Weiss. Nice to meet you, Mark. Tell us what to do. Wow. I'll never forget it.
So the record company sends him, huh?
Yeah, hired by the record company. Because he was a big deal. All his stuff was doing well, and obviously he worked well with the bands because he's a rocker, and he wasn't just some, you know, professional photographer. He was a rocker, too, you know, who happened to be good eye, you know. Good ideas on how to get people to sort of sell what it is that you're trying to do here. So,
yeah, because even in the photo, you guys look like a hard rock band from Texas without even knowing nothing about you.
It's funny. It's funny because it looks like we're climbing a tree.
Yeah. It does kind of look like it.
But the band's called Dangerous Toys, so obviously there's some youth, you know, so it's kind of, there's something in there that makes the photo work. Whether you like it or not, there is something in there that makes a photo work with the band and the attitude. And, oh, look at these guys climbing a tree. That's weird, you know. Yeah, I'm leaning up against a fence. So, yeah, that was that. I learned a lot. I keep saying that. But, you know, we didn't know. We had taken band photos before. We thought they were pretty good, and I still think that they were pretty good. But having someone who does it all the time, some supervision, he was able to really kind of mold something cool that day.
Right. And it sets you guys apart from what else is going on. So, you know, then like you got guys on their Harleys riding down the Sunset Strip, you know, all the LA, they're on top of a building with a city backdrop or something, but this sets you apart. You know, Mark probably knew that, you know, said this is perfect because it shows you are hard rock, but it also shows you're different from everything else that's out there right now.
I think that was by default because we don't ride. I think motorcycles are badass. I've been in love with motorcycles my whole life, but I don't ride. So that wasn't real. If we would, you know, rent a bunch of Harleys and have us sitting on, or even like hot rods, you know, that's just not, we didn't do that. So the bullet belt and the leather jacket that I'm donning that day, that was really me. That's what I wore all the time.
Well, I suppose when Mark calls you, he doesn't say, hey, get dressed up and come down here.
No,
he says, come over here in an hour.
Yeah, it was easy for us to just show up in some jackets and boots and go, here it is. And he was like, yeah, looks great. There was no like, hey, hold on a second. Kind of reminds me of the story Eddie Ojeda told us at Rockin' Pod about his shoes. Remember that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. On the cover shot of Stay Hungry, when it's the band photo, you look at his shoes, and he was saying, I like comfortable shoes, and I didn't know they were going to shoot our feet. I thought it was going to be from the waist up, and that's what I get for thinking, but he said, record company, somebody gave him shit about his shoes, you know. So I don't know what his shoes look like, but
I think they're just brown.
Obviously they didn't bother me.
I don't think anyone noticed.
No, that's funny. That's funny. But the attention to detail is great. And probably Eddie didn't think anything of it, and his band was like, oh, that's Eddie. Who gives a shit? But then someone who's eyeballing the photographs and doing the layout of the album covers, like, hey, I gotta make a phone call. What the fuck is it, really? Is this the shot you guys want to use? Look at Eddie's shoes. And people are like, oh yeah, okay. And then they call the band and the band's like, the fuck.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird.
It is weird.
But if that wouldn't have happened, if you would have been wearing the perfect shoes, we wouldn't have this cool story. So
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. So Sunset Valley, Texas is where that photo was taken. It was a great day. It was, the weather was good. We he took us all to see Bon Jovi, Skid Row. We had never heard of Skid Row. His new band, blah blah blah, my friends touring with my friend Bon Jovi. So got us all in, and he took a couple of quick snaps. I think one of the photos of me and John was in Metal Edge like a year later. And you can see I'm wearing the same shirt, I'm dressed exactly the same as I was in the photo for the album cover.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I got rid of the bullet belt. I'm not going to walk into a – that's a bit much. I was tired, too. I probably wasn't going to walk around with a bullet belt on at a Bon Jovi concert.
So then I guess I got one more question about the layout of the CD. In the back – there's a poem.
Mm-hmm.
What is up with that? Is that something you guys put in there, or is that just something they added? Or,
well, they needed another panel, right? They needed a frame. They needed another panel. I think Tommy, the artist, drew that the clown coming at slightly through the lid, reaching for the mallet.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it was like a grayscale. So it wasn't going to be, it wasn't colored. It was probably something he did on a request from management, because we needed another panel. You got the lyrics on just on one side, and well, we're kind of got this whole other side of the sleeve on the inner sleeve here. I had written that. I don't really like to call it a poem, but I guess it's a poem. I had written that, and I was, management had called me and said, hey, we need something. You got anything? Something like what? You know, and, well, I wrote this poem. You want to print that? Yeah. Fax it to me. See what it is. And that was it. I didn't change anything on it. I just wrote that out like in a stupor, like late night. I think I just wrote that. And when I think about that poem, the part that kind of sticks out odd to me is the something about life is not just a plate of milk and cookies or something, cookies and milk or something like that. It brings you down to earth for a second, because it's a bunch of kind of hippie shit.
Yeah.
About sort of like it's karma and it's
no tears, no funerals. But not always a glass of milk with cookies either.
Yeah, you don't want to think that life is going to be easy all the time, and you don't want life to be hard. But it is, so it's kind of this circle that you're living in, and you don't really, you just have a turn signal, but that's, you have to decide to go left or right. So you're, is it going to be box number one, door number two, slide number three? You know. You don't know. So I think that's where I was in my head when I wrote that.
And then the poem is credited to William, which we learned today is your first name.
That's my first name. That. And a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
And they put it together later, maybe, or they ask me in an interview, who the fuck is William? Why is
I only knew it because I booked his flight for Rockin' Pod.
Yeah.
You could have told me who wrote the poem in the back, Sinzak, when you found out, but now I just
found better
out
coming
today.
From William himself than from
yeah,
me.
Yeah. I only get called William in grade school and at the doctor's office, the DMV, places like that.
Yeah,
I answer to William in those professional places. My parents didn't even call me William. It's family name. My dad was named William, but I'm not a junior. Like, even my dad called me Jason all the time. So, like, never, ever called me William. or Billy, or my dad went by Bill. So,
well, and the clown's name is Bill.
Yeah, Beelzebub, which is just a spin on Beelzebub. So, and I think that was me and Tommy having a conversation. What are we going to call this stupid ripoff of Eddie with clown makeup?
Yeah.
Oh, how about Beelzebub? Beelzebub, like Beelzebub. Okay, I love it. Perfect. It was literally went like that.
I thought it was interesting that the album came out kind of around the same time as the Stephen King's It miniseries.
And Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
That's right.
And if you remember the clown masks that those guys were wearing, those actors were wearing in Killer Clowns, it's strange that some of them sort of resemble the sketches from the Illusion Factory, the ones on the Jack in the Box and the ones that I described in those early faxes that I said, fuck to the no. We ain't using that shit. And a lot of people thought that Tommy was, maybe he was and didn't feel it. Maybe he was ghosting that, but he wasn't intentional. Killer Clowns as well as It. But even It kind of had a round face.
Yeah.
And so when you think about the Joker, old Joker comics, his face is really long. He's got this chin that looks like a ball sack, you know, that thing. Whatever is going on there, I feel like is where it's coming from. So it's a lot of things. Sure, it's Eddie from Iron Maiden. Sure, it's the Joker. Sure, it's Killer Clowns. Sure, it's It. It's all of that stuff. So the people who are afraid of clowns, they don't care where Tommy got it from.
They just don't like it.
Or do they? You see where I'm maybe going
they
with
like,
this? That,
maybe ties, they like being scared.
Ties in. Exactly. They see, you know where I'm at. That ties in with the song. It ties in with the whole idea behind the name of the band. And kind of worked
awesome.
Out.
Awesome.
Kind of worked out.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have, you know, we don't have much of a career after that first record. And so we just milked the shit out of that first record. And that, we're fine with that. Sure, there's new songs. Sure, there's new songs that aren't recorded yet that are done being written. Sure, we put out 3 more studio records after that debut. Mm-hmm. Live album, live DVD. That first album became an underground classic, if you will.
Yep. I think so, yeah.
I'm not trying to give it its own legs. I think that it kind of speaks for itself because there's a lot of fans that swear by it and tattoo it on their bodies and whatever. So, I feel good about it.
Was there anything extra recorded during the sessions of this that didn't make the album that might be out there somewhere?
Nope. We had some other songs that had been being played live prior to the record deal, you know, that we had written that we were just playing for fun. And I can't even think of any titles, but there was probably a good handful of them, 5, 6 songs that we didn't really feel they were strong enough to present. Or if we did, we were correct and they didn't get chosen. So part of the story about us going out, it wasn't like we got on a plane and went to LA and our friends drove our U-Haul out with some gear and we just went to Sound City and stayed there. The label had rented us some cars and apartments, so we had to live out there for a few months. And this would have been probably October of 89. And the first thing we did, I want to say it was like the next day. Like, we got there, we got settled in our rooms and stuff, and like the next day we went to SBK. They had an office down on Sunset, and we went to their offices, and they had a studio in the first floor. I remember it well because it was pretty much right across the street from the old Tower Records on Sunset, and you could look out the window of the studio and see Tower Records. which I thought was pretty cool. But that's the first day we met Max and, you know, got a feel for him. And it was real quick. Hey, Max, nice to meet you. That was it. Hey, where's some coffee? And, you know, we weren't hanging out immediately. It was just like, let's get to work.
Right.
They mic'd us up. We recorded. He goes, he gets on the talkback, record, play every song you know. Seriously. Every, and we're like looking around. Every song we know. Yeah. Even cover songs. Whatever you feel like you want to throw down on here, just do it. I'm going to hit record and you're just going to fucking play all day. All right. So we did. We just started jamming. Pick a song, go. Pick a song, go. Pick a song, go. We might have recorded, I don't know, 14 songs. Ironically, we recorded Love Hurts.
By Nazareth?
Yeah. There were, we probably recorded some extra songs that day during that initial recording, but it was just a two-track, not a multi-track. It was live. And I may have that floating around, but you'll never hear it.
Oh, man. Yeah. You say that until somebody comes around and says, we want to do a deluxe edition of that first Dangerous Toys album. Then we'll see what you pull out of the vault. But, man, this
you'll
has been awesome.
Mind. When you hear it, you'll go, oh, yeah, this stinks. Yeah, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate you guys very much, more than you actually know.
It was fun to do this.
Yeah, I feel like I've learned a lot about an album I already loved.
Yeah, same here.
That's beautiful.
And so you said there is stuff that's been recorded for possible new material?
Yeah, it's not mixed and, you know, it's not ready yet. And there's other new songs that are written that just haven't been recorded yet. You know, there's no budget. There's no timeline. There's no deadline. There's no, so, you know.
So, but someday we're going to get another Dangerous Toys
maybe,
album?
Maybe I can say this. Don't hold your breath. Some of us are just into the process and want to get it. Some of us are, you know, gung-ho all the time. Oh, that's slowing down. I'm going to go somewhere else and use my time elsewhere.
Oh, well, then let me put it like this.
No bitterness. There's no bitterness. It's just some people are go, 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 and other people are like, let me think about this for about 7 years.
Oh, man. All right. Well, let me put it like this. May we have another? Please,
you,
someday.
Don't hold your breath. It's possible. My parts are done.
Yeah.
Mic drop. Yeah, my parts are done, bro.
Hey, everybody else, let's get it together.
I can't just release the vocal track.
Sure you can.
Oh, man. Where's Max Norman when you need him to crack that whip?
Well, he costs money.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he costs a lot of money, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well, Jason, thanks again for doing this.
Yeah,
and
my pleasure.
People can find you on Facebook, all the social media, all that good stuff.
Yep.
Talk Louder Podcast.
Talk Louder Podcast. Great show.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.